The following sermon was recorded in Westminster Chapel on Sunday evening, May the 12th, 1957. Dr. Lloyd-Jones is continuing his series from Numbers 11, verses 4, 5 and 6. Unfortunately, the introductory remarks to this sermon are now missing. We now join the doctor as he is reviewing the living conditions of the Jews during their time of exile in Egypt. Here's Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones.
Not only that, they treated them very cruelly. Taskmasters were appointed over them. They were making bricks. They kept them short with a supply of straw and then punished them because they didn't produce the right and the given number. They were cruelly persecuted. Indeed, they had become slaves. Were utterly helpless and powerless. But God, in his infinite kindness and mercy, raised up Moses and sent him, you remember, to the children of Israel, and in a most astonishing manner led them out, led them through the Red Sea, where their enemies, Pharaoh and his hosts, were drowned, and landing on the other side, he led them in the direction of the land of Canaan. He had promised he would give them that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and they might have got into it very quickly, but because of their own sin and folly, they were condemned to traveling in the wilderness for 40 years. And it was in the wilderness they were when this particular incident that we are now concerned about took place. Now, that is the background that we must keep obviously in our minds if we are to understand the real significance of this particular incident. Here are these people to whom all that had happened, complaining in the wilderness and saying, "Who will give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic, but now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all but this manna before our eyes, this manna which was bread sent from heaven, God's miraculous way of feeding them." That's how they describe it. And they look back with longing to all that they used to eat in Egypt in the time of their captivity. Now, I'm calling attention to this incident because, as I was indicating last Sunday evening, it really does put in a very clear and pictorial manner, in a manner that I take it we shall never forget because of the character of the incident, what is the essence of the problem of men in this world at this very moment? We all know about the problem. We all can see the state of the world. And we're all aware of all the methods that are being employed in order to attempt to deal with it. I was quoting last Sunday night a great mental expert, an authority on mental health in this country, who said the time surely has come when we should set up a research party, such as we do for the investigation of cancer and of poliomyelitis, to look, he says, into this whole social and moral problem of marriage and divorce in particular. It's time, he said, that we began to do this thing scientifically. Otherwise, our civilization is going to be shipwrecked. Now, my suggestion is that there is no need to set up a new research department. There is no need to spend thousands, perhaps millions of pounds in investigations. The whole trouble with men and the whole trouble with the world tonight is clearly set forth in this Bible already. There's no need to try and discover a diagnosis. The diagnosis is here before us. It's the whole message of the Bible. The Bible is a book about life. It's a book about men and women like ourselves. It comes to us from God as the explanation of our troubles and problems and difficulties, and with the glorious announcement of the only remedy for such a condition that can possibly work. But in particular, I am emphasizing this, that there is no hope whatsoever for this generation or any other generation until we are clear about this diagnosis. As long as men think that just a change of government is going to put everything right, they are indeed beyond hope. As long as they think that some scientific investigation or the multiplication of certain social services are really going to put the world in order, I say as long as they believe a thing like that, they are indeed entirely without hope. Why? Well, for this reason. That those proffered remedies, those panaceas, are so utterly and completely superficial in their diagnosis. They betray the fact that they've never realized the character and the true nature of the problem. They think that it's something on the surface, so it can be put right easily. Whereas the problem of men, as he is in the world tonight, is profound. The trouble with men is a radical trouble. And it is because these three verses give us an insight into the radical nature of the problem of men in this world this evening that I'm calling attention to them. Of course, the Bible says the same thing everywhere. I'm taking this particular instance, as I say, because it puts it so clearly, and it puts it in such an extraordinary, pictorial and dramatic manner. Now then, last Sunday evening I showed you that the Bible says that all men's troubles are due to what it calls sin. Everything is due to sin. Sin is that which has entered into us and has ruined life and ruined men. Now, I'm using my terms advisedly. Sin has ruined men. It's as terrible as that. And here we are shown of some of the things that sin has done to men. Now, last Sunday evening, I pointed out to you how this incident teaches us very plainly that sin has turned men into a creature of lust and of craving. Man is a creature, as the result of sin, who is controlled and governed by desire, passion, lust, craving. I showed you how it is something that comes and takes hold of a people and of the individual, as it took hold of these. The mixed multitude that was among them, there they are going on in their journey, they suddenly fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, well, what made them do this? There's no explanation at all except this lust that was within them. And that's the whole explanation of life, as I try to show. That's why there's so much misery and unhappiness. That's why there are so many broken hearts in the world tonight. Lust, passion, desire, craving. And I spent my time in pointing out this, that this principle of lust that is in men, what the New Testament calls the dominion of sin, is the most powerful thing in all our experiences. It's more powerful than our minds and reasons. It's more powerful than our wills. Our wills are in bondage. We do things though we know they're wrong. We are driven by this lust, this craving. The conscience speaks its silence. Memory speaks its silence. Fear speaks it is silence. Lust, it comes upon us and it grips us and it overmasters us and we are helpless victims in its hand. That's life, isn't it? These people fell a-lusting. And in some shape or form, we're all victims of this. It isn't always the same form, you see. Don't confine lust to sex. There are lusts of the mind, according to the Apostle Paul. And what is anger and what is jealousy and envy? What are these things but lusts? A desire for greatness or for position or for success or power. It's lust. It manifests itself in endless ways. Ah, yes, there was the first thing, but you see, it isn't the only thing. That isn't all. I want to direct your attention this evening to another thing that sin has done to men. It follows directly out of the previous one. There's a logical sequence in these things. Because man is thus a victim and a creature of lust, it means that sin has done something terrible to his mind, to the mind of men. And I suppose there is nothing more tragic about men than what sin has done to his mind. Now, as I've just reminded you, I was showing last Sunday night that this power of lust is more powerful than a man's reason. But that isn't all we've got to say about that. We must elaborate it because it is something that comes out so clearly in these three verses. Let me show it to you. Mind, after all, is one of God's greatest gifts to men, if not the greatest of all. Mind is that which differentiates men from the animal. Man has been given this faculty that enables him to look on at himself and to consider himself and to reason about himself and about life. This power of objectivity and of consideration and of thought and of analysis, the mind. Oh, what a tremendous thing the mind is. Are you surprised to hear a Christian preacher saying something like that? Had you thought that religion and Christianity were but sub stuff? My dear friends, it's Christianity alone, as I'm going to show you, that really appreciates the greatness of the mind of man. Part of God's image in men is the mind of man. And of course, we all know, do we not, that man is very proud of his mind. The modern man especially is proud of his mind, his intellect, his reason, his understanding. And there is nothing which he pits perhaps so frequently against Christianity and the Christian way of life as his mind. The vast majority of people are not in places of worship in this country tonight. And if you were to go to them and to ask them why they're not, in some shape or form, the vast majority would tell you that they are not in a place of worship because they've got minds. Because they've got reason. Because they've got understanding. It is in terms of the mind and the intellect and the understanding that they reject the gospel. And they say that anybody who still believes it is patently showing that he can't think, he can't reason, he's burying his head in the sand, he's jettisoned his mind, he's committed intellectual suicide, they say. But they are reasoners, and they think, and they have minds. The rationalist press association, the rationalization, the thinking over and against Christianity, which is just emotionalism. Which is just sub-stuff, as I say, which is just a fantasy and being wafted up into a realm of the immaterial where you forget your problems and your trouble for the nonce. Now, isn't that the position? Man is proud of his mind. And he claims that he is not a Christian and not religious and perchance not even a believer in God. Because of this tremendous faculty that he possesses and which he is employing, the mind. Now here, you see, comes the clash, the complete clash with the biblical teaching. And it was all summarized in that first verse of the 14th Psalm that we read just now. Listen, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. It's the fool who said that. God speaks from heaven and says, is there no one with understanding? Is there no one who can think and reason? Have they all gone mad? The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Very well, the fundamental proposition of the Bible can be put in this form. that man, as the result of sin, is no longer governed by his mind. The whole trouble with man in sin is that he's become a fool, that he's governed by anything and everything except his mind. He's lost his understanding. He's lost his way. He can't think, he can't reason. And all I want to try to show you is that that is the solemn truth about everybody who isn't a Christian tonight. Christianity anti-intellectual. Christianity is the only true intellectualism. All else is folly and madness and nonsense. Let me prove it. Now I want to prove it to you this evening entirely in terms of these three verses and the incident which they record. I could add to it, but I'm deliberately letting this picture speak to us. Now, what does it tell us here? What is it that sin has done to the mind of men? Well, the first thing that I find here is this, that sin has made the mind of men empty. Man has got an empty mind. Where do you find that, says someone? Well, I find it here. It is because man's mind is empty that things keep on coming into it. If it were full, there'd be no room for them. You see, here are these children of Israel traveling. They've been brought out of Egypt. They're on their way to Canaan. Here they are on the journey. Suddenly they began to think. Where did it come from? A thought came. Ah, you see, it's because their minds were empty that things like that happened to them. If these people had got a working philosophy, if they'd understood their own history and experience, if these people had but got the doctrine of God that they should have had, that had been taught them by their fathers, they would have had such a complete and entire view of life that this sort of thing, though it might offer itself to them, would be dismissed at once. But you see, their minds were vacant. The Apostle Paul puts this by talking about the vanity of mind of the Gentiles, the vacuity of the Gentiles, the vacant mind. It means, I say, that they have no central understanding of life. They have no real philosophy of life. They have no controlling view of life. Or let me put it in a phrase that I'm fond of quoting. They do not correspond to Matthew Arnold's definition of a true man. This is it. He sees life steadily and he sees it whole. The trouble with men in sin is that he really hasn't got a mind that is filled with a great idea, a marvelous concept, a view, an understanding, and a philosophy. And the result is, because it's empty, things come in from all directions and he's their victim. And he doesn't know what he's going to do next. Suddenly this, suddenly that. Now that's the picture which we are given here. You see, it is because man's mind is not filled with God and the teaching of the Bible and the biblical and godly view of life. It is because of that, I say, that man's mind becomes the prey to any passing thought or any passing idea or any passing desire. What is it? Satan has always plenty of work to give empty hands to do. It's a man who doesn't quite know what to do with himself, who's sitting there, who's most likely to fall into temptation. He's a man who really hasn't got a full mind, you see, so he's sitting in his hotel and he doesn't know what to do with himself. He's read all the papers. What next? He doesn't know, you see. There's nothing central. There's nothing controlling. And so temptation comes and the vacancy is there and it enters in and down he's gone. Or he's walking about the streets aimlessly. He doesn't know what he wants to do. He doesn't know where he wants to go. He's got no philosophy of life. He's got an empty mind. And suddenly the enemy darts in a dart at him. And he's gone. He's full. Oh, this is a terrible thing. But it's the explanation of most of life today, isn't it? You see, it's because people's minds are so empty that you get what are called fashions of thought. Have you noticed them, how they come and how they go? It's all this at one particular time, and the other thing is scouted and dismissed. But you wait a few years, they'll all be after that and scouting this. Fashions of thought. You get it in the learned professions, you get it in farming, you get it everywhere. Everybody's doing this at one time. Nobody's doing that. Then everybody's doing that and nobody's doing this. Fashions of thought. It'd be very interesting. I could keep you at great length in just giving you a history of the change in the fashions of thought. Or let me give you perhaps what has been the most striking illustration in this present century. Let me take a political illustration. Do you remember what most people in this country used to think and say, what all the newspapers practically said about a man like Sir Winston Churchill, say from 1930 to 1938? Impossible, they said. Nobody can work with him. Difficult man. Always wrong in his judgments. Always says the wrong thing. Look at his record. Look what he did in Antwerp. Look what he did in the Dardanelles. Keep him out. And they kept him in the wilderness. A hopeless man, they said. They were saying it day after day in the House of Parliament, in the newspapers, on the street corners. He was an impossible man. Then, of course, since the war, they've been virtually worshipping him, and he can do no wrong. He's now the fount of all wisdom. And he never makes a mistake and never says anything wrong. That's the sort of thing I'm thinking of. Fashions of thought. Yes, you see, men and women today, in spite of education, are exactly like the people who lived in the island of Malta in the time of the Apostle Paul. You remember what happened. He was shipwrecked and he landed on the island. And then the moment he had landed, as they lit a fire out of some sticks, and a serpent came out and bit the Apostle Paul. Ah, they said, this man must be a great sinner. He's been bitten by a serpent and he's going to die. And they were expecting him to drop dead at any moment. They said, he's a vile person, he's got a devil. But then, miraculously, you see, the apostle was healed. The next moment they were worshipping him as a god. Read the account in Acts chapter 28. That's the sort of quick change in fashion. And it's all due to the empty mind. It means that people, you see, haven't got a real judgment. They haven't got a whole view. So they're the victims of any stray thought that may come along. Anything may prey upon them and enter into them. Fashions of thought, rapid changes. And, of course, crazes. What everybody's doing, we must all do. And the result of all this, not for me to keep you with this particular point, is this. It is because the mind of men today is so much in sin that the modern man is such an obvious and a tragic victim of propaganda. If you go plugging a thing at him, he'll eventually believe it. Why, well, he's got no resistance, you see. He hasn't got a belief. He hasn't got a philosophy. His mind is empty. So if you go on pushing the same thing in, it'll lodge there. And keep on doing it and don't let anybody else get in. And yours will stay there. Propaganda. And men can be manipulated. Hitler knew that. And there are others who still know it. This, I say, is one of the major explanations of the state of the world today. It's the whole explanation of the history of this 20th century. Man has turned his back upon God. And when you turn your back upon God and God goes out of your life, your mind becomes empty. It's vacant. You drive out the devil and the seven others come in. And it was because of their vacant mind that the children of Israel at this point became victims of this lust and put forward this request. But let me go on to the second point in the analysis. Sin not only makes our minds empty, it also makes them uncritical. Sin takes from men the power of criticism. Ah, criticism is a wonderful thing. Now, when I say criticism, I'm using it in its technical sense. There's nothing more interesting than to have a good and an intelligent criticism of a book, or a piece of music, or a performance of a piece of music, a critique. The power of discrimination and the ability to criticize is a very rare gift indeed, but it's a very precious one. And you know that it's one of the things that is destroyed by sin always. Sin, first of all, blunts and then finally destroys a man's critical faculty. It renders him incapable of testing ideas and sifting them. You see, it puts him into the position of these children of Israel, that the moment a thought comes, he accepts it uncritically and carries it out. He doesn't stop to think. He doesn't work it out. He doesn't take the trouble to work it right through. He doesn't even consider possible consequences. No, he only has one thing at a time, and he lives for the present, and he really doesn't take an idea that offers itself and subject it to a profound analysis and criticism in order to see what it really is. Now, isn't that very obvious about these children of Israel? Here they are, you see, in the journey, and the idea comes, and at once they begin shouting, and they begin weeping and crying. Why didn't they stop and think? Why didn't they begin to reason? Why didn't they say, now, what if we do this? What are the consequences? Why should we want this? What was the position? What's the position like? No, they don't ask any such question. The idea came, and they accepted it. It stimulated the lust. And they began to plead for the fish and the food. Now in the New Testament, you get this selfsame thing put like this. We are told of Moses, the very man that was leading these children of Israel, that he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Why? Well, the explanation goes on and tells us it was that he had his eye on the recompense of the reward. You see, the choice was there before Moses. He might have continued as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. There were great prospects in the court and in other respects. But we are told that Moses elected and chose rather to suffer affliction with this handful of people. And it was because he thought and reasoned and criticized and analyzed. Now, my friends, let's transfer this to the modern age and to the modern men. The vast majority of people in this country today are rejecting this gospel. They are deliberately choosing that worldly kind of life they live, and they glory in it, and they say it's marvelous and wonderful, and they're a great crowd, and they're all shouting together, and they all would have us believe that they're very happy, and they're all doing it. Why? Well, I say it's still the same. It's the lack of criticism. It is the lack of thought. It is the lack of reason. What is it that they're failing to ask? Well, they're just failing to ask certain obvious questions, and here are some of them. What is the real value of this life that we are living actually, even in the present? Is it ennobling? Is it uplifting? Is it enriching to the mind and the intellect and the heart? Is it of any real benefit to mankind? Where does it lead me? How will it help me if I'm suddenly taken ill? If I suddenly lose my health or lose my job? How will it help me if I suddenly lose a loved one by death? What'll be my own position at the end of such a life and when I myself come to die? What'll be my position beyond death? What is there there? Ah, says the modern man uncritically, those are morbid questions. And especially perhaps those who are young are tempted to say that You don't think that such questions appeal to me and are relevant to my position? Well, my friend, I've got a most terrible answer to give you to that statement, and it's this. I went into my vestry at the close of the morning service this morning, and I was told these two things. Now, I'm saying this as just facts. First of all, I was told that a schoolboy who had been brought to one of our services here but a few weeks ago, suddenly in the gymnasium of his school this last week, dropped down dead. A schoolboy. I don't know the cause of death, but it's happened. Here's a boy in school, as you would imagine and reason, with the whole of his life before him. How little did he think a few weeks ago when he sat here that in a few weeks he'd have gone out of the world? But he's gone. And then I had a father and a mother who came in to see me, to tell me that their darling boy, aged 18, had got a cancerous growth in his arm, and that the most the doctors could offer at the height of their optimism was 12 months. I hope you'll all who are Christians pray for that boy and for that father and mother. Pray God for a miracle. Pray that they may be given grace to submit to the will of God and to God's way, and to believe that it's always good whatever may happen. But I'm quoting the incident to you just to tell you that if you think you can argue in terms of age or health or anything else, I've only one thing to say to you, and I say it very plainly and bluntly. You're a fool. You're just a simple fool. And it's the only language to use. Our whole life in this world is uncertain. Nothing is more uncertain. We can guarantee nothing. We don't know whether we'll be alive tomorrow. We are all together in the hands of God, and death must come, and God and judgment. Have you considered these things? Where's your critical faculty? When that thought comes, turn your back on the church. Turn your back on Christ and Christianity. Plunge into pleasure. Live the worldly life. Have you examined it? Where is it going to land you? Don't be a fool. A man who doesn't reason and ask questions and think and consider and estimate is a man who has an uncritical mind. I say again, he is a fool. But let me hasten on. The next thing I want to observe is this, that sin makes our minds prejudiced and dishonest. Now let me prove this to you. We hear a great deal today about free thought. Well, if there is one thing about which we can absolutely be certain, it is this: there is no such thing as free thought. We are every one of us the creatures of prejudice. Our minds are made up before we listen to the evidence, and we never really consider all the evidence. We decide on our verdict before we've listened to counsel. Prejudice. Now, let me show it to you in this particular instance. Have you ever seen a more glaring case of it? Here are these people on their journey on the way to Canaan. The thought comes about the fish. And then they look back into Egypt and they say, "Ah, we remember the fish that we used to eat in the land of Egypt so freely. The cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic." What are they doing? Well, they're looking back at their life in Egypt. And what's the conclusion they come to? They come to the conclusion that it was a marvelous life. They wish they were back there, eating the fish and the garlic and the leeks and the onions and the melons. And this manna, they say, this wretched, constant manna, Here they are, they're looking at a position, and they arrive at a judgment. And I say that's nothing here but prejudice. How do I prove it like this? They look back at their life in Egypt, and what do they emphasize? They emphasize one part of the story, and they deliberately suppress the other. You see, looking back, this is what they say. Oh, you know that life in Egypt. Do you remember the fish? Do you remember the leeks and the garlic and the melons and the onions? But what about the floggings? What about the whip? Not a word about the whipping. Not a word about the flogging. There was nothing there but food, luxury, plenty, marvelous meals. They don't say a single word about the suffering, about making bricks without straw, and all the agony and all the suffering through which they went. Now, my friends, I say there's only one thing to say about that. That is sheer dishonesty. That's manipulating the facts. That is suppressing the unpleasant, overemphasizing the pleasant. It isn't really thinking straightly. It is sheer dishonesty. How modern these people are. You know, it is because people still do the same that they think they can dismiss Christianity with a wave of the hand. Christianity, they say. Christianity. There was a man living next door to me. He was a great Christian, always going to his place of worship. And he did the dirtiest trick I've ever seen in my life. So much for your Christianity. Doesn't say a word about the great record of the Christian church. Doesn't say a word about the Son of God who left the courts of heaven and came and was born as a babe in Bethlehem. Doesn't say a word about his sweating blood in the garden and dying on the cross for those who were his enemies. Not a word about all the saints and all the benefactors that this world has known in the life of the Christian church. Not a word. One man, one bit of evidence, and all the rest suppressed. That's not reason. That's not thinking. That's prejudice and abuse. That's sheer dishonesty. My friend, have you rejected Christianity? Well, let me ask you a few straight questions. Have you ever read the Bible right through? Have you? Have you even read the New Testament right through? Do you know what Christianity really is? How many books have you read on it? How much trouble have you taken to investigate its story and its claims and its amazing history? Come. Have you really faced all the facts? Have you really said, very well, I've heard the case for the prosecution. Will counsel for the defense now speak? Have you looked at both sides? Have you been honest? Have you had all the facts before you? Or have you just taken one side that you happen to agree with and that pleases you? And have you deliberately suppressed all the other and dismissed it in your prejudice? Now, what are the facts? Well, I've only to ask my question. For us all to know perfectly well what the facts are. Man's mind, as the result of sin, has become dishonest. It's hopelessly prejudiced. It's almost incredible that these people should do a thing like this, isn't it? But they did it. Not a word about the unpleasant, only that which was pleasant. And so it is still. Poor modern sinful man. He's blinded by the God of this world, lest he believe the gospel of Christ. He's so blinded by his prejudice and his ignorance that he doesn't know what it is. It is the fool that says in his heart, there is no God. And let me come to my last point, which is this. Sin debases the mind of men and debases his judgment. What do I mean? I mean this. Man is the result of the effect of sin upon his mind. seems to be incapable of grasping principles. He simply is interested in feelings and sensations and pleasure and joy. Now let me illustrate it in the case of these people. I put it to you that this is one of the most amazing things that the children of Israel ever did. What I can't get over is this, that it was ever possible for the children of Israel to speak of Egypt like this. Listen to them. We remember the fish that we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. That's how they speak of Egypt. I say it's almost incredible that they could ever have done that. What does it indicate? It indicates this. It indicates to me quite clearly that the only thing that really troubled them and worried them when they were in Egypt was not their state and condition, but only their suffering. They don't seem to have realized that the most terrible thing about their position when they were in Egypt was not simply that they were maltreated, not simply that they suffered pains on their poor backs when they were lashed with the whips, but that they were slaves, that they were serfs, that they'd lost their liberty. They never seem to have realized that, because looking back, you see, all they think about is these pleasures that they enjoyed. They never got at the principle. And equally clearly, I can put it like this. Isn't it equally patent about them that here now in this wilderness, they don't really value their freedom? They don't say a word about freedom. All they're interested in is food. You see, it doesn't seem to enter into their minds that over and above what you eat and what you enjoy are certain great positions, that a man may be a slave or that he may be a free man. But freedom and slavery don't seem to count with these people. They're only interested in sensations and feelings and enjoyment and in luxury. So they're in this terrible position that they put fish before freedom, that they put leeks before liberty. My heart breaks as I think of them. Here are men who'd been slaves. They've been brought out by the mighty action of God. They're free men in a wilderness. But that means nothing to them. Ah, they say, where are the leeks and the melons and the fish and the garlic? What a terrible thing sin is. It makes a man more interested in his enjoyments and pleasures than in his state and in his condition. Now I believe that it is this that accounts for most of our troubles in this country today. With all the dread possibilities in this modern world, I read an article by a man the other day and I agree with what he said. He said, though the world is as it is, the vast majority of people are not interested. As long as they can look at their television and have their smokes and their drinks and go on getting money for nothing, they care nothing about it. What's it mean? Interested in fish and leeks and garlic and melons rather than in the state and the condition of men and the whole future of the human race. And indeed, as I was suggesting a few months ago, isn't this the very essence even of our industrial and economic position today? Everybody's interested in fish and leeks and garlic and melons, and let the country go where it will. All I'm interested in is my pay packet or my bank balance and my enjoyment, these things that I want to enjoy. The whole future of the country seems to be irrelevant as long as we can continue with our present pleasures and enjoyment. Oh, what a tragic thing sin is. It has so warped these men's minds, and it so ruined them, that they can look back at Egypt and praise it. I say, sooner be a free man on a starvation diet than to have all the fish of the universe and melons and leeks and garlic and onions in slavery and serfdom. But sin, you see, has destroyed the noblest thing that is in men. It has destroyed his own conception of himself, of his dignity, of his manhood, of his greatness as made in the image of God. He's become a creature who simply wants his desires and passions and lusts satisfied. And he's lost this fact that he's an upright man and meant for liberty and meant for knowledge of God. He can forget slavery as long as his animal desires are gratified. Oh, my dear friends, I'm calling your attention to this incident, as I say, because I would have you see that sin is that which destroys the very thing that makes man, man. It's insulting to human nature. It's insulting to men. Man is not a creature who's to be satisfied with things like this. What these people should have said is this. It's true that our diet is rather monotonous. It's always manna, day after day. But thank God, we are free. We are at liberty. We are men again. We are our own masters. And Pharaoh and his hosts are destroyed. Let them keep their leeks and garlic and onions. We'll never barter our liberty for such things. If you are not a Christian tonight, you are just a slave of the world and the flesh and the devil. And the more you boast to me about the marvelous time you're having, the more I see your slavery. Because you don't realize that you're the victim of these things and are held in their grip. Try and break free and you'll find how much a slave you are. What about your soul? What about your human dignity and greatness? What about your knowledge of God? A man who can boast about the kind of life that is being lived by the average non-Christian today is simply proclaiming that he can't think, that he has lost his critical faculty, that his prejudice, that his judgment is debased, that he doesn't even know what a man is. Leave alone God. Oh, my dear friend, have you seen it? Have you seen yourself in the grip of this fell disease, this foul canker, this mastery, this dominion of sin and Satan? If you have, you will realize that your first need is the need to have your mind renewed, set at liberty, rendered capable of thought and analysis and understanding. And you can't do that for yourself. And the world can't, and the philosophers can't, because they're bound themselves and blinded and prejudiced. No one can do it for you but one, the Son of God. He came from heaven to earth to set the captives free, to give sight to the blind, understanding to the fools. And he can set you free. He can give you a new nature, a new mind, a new understanding, a new outlook. And when you've got it, you'll hate that old life, whatever it may have given you. You'll see that it's empty and dying. And you'll see that you were a slave. And you'll thank him, the Son of God, who said, if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. Have you seen the slavery? Have you seen what sin has done to you? Well, if you have, go to God without any delay. Acknowledge it and confess it. Give in. Acknowledge your ignorance, your arrogance especially. Cast yourself at his mercy and at his feet. And ask him to open your eyes by the Holy Spirit to see this Son of God, Jesus, who came to bear your sins in his own body on the tree, and who's taken your sins away and who'll reconcile you to God and give you this new life and outlook and understanding and energy and power and enable you to enjoy the glorious liberty of the children of God, and continue in your march towards that heavenly Canaan, where you shall feast with Christ to all eternity. Amen.